approaching the topic of gratitude as the standard kind of Dharma framework for Thanksgiving week, of course, is, we might say now, extremely problematic, along with being beautiful and for many of us, a powerful and healing practice. Right now we're in Prescott, Arizona, staying with old high school friends of my partner's, an old high school friend of my partner's and her children, a 20-year-old and then two youngers, 9 and 11 or so. And we were talking about it over dinner tonight, and the 9-year-old said, "Oh yeah, in my class, you know, the whole conversation now is about how all the old stories are wrong. That, like, you know, it's not like there were pilgrims, there were Indians, they were starving, they gave food, everyone was happy." And she was like, "It didn't happen like that." And I'm like, "You're 9 in Arizona, this is what you're learning in school." She's actually learning some of the more accurate politics, as far as we can tell, and the history there, the tragedy there. So, you know, so bit by bit, Thanksgiving, in the way that I at least was raised in it, has been, you know, falling from grace, appropriately, in the post-colonial era. So I'm not going to give a straight ahead talk on gratitude, but I want to read you a couple short discourses from the early Buddhist scriptures, and speak a bit about gratitude and how awesome it is, and then a bit about a topic that is another one of the standard Dharma topics for Thanksgiving week, which is how to go home to your family and talk about anything besides politics without getting in an argument about politics. And so we'll talk a little bit about what to do with our unruly parents. Should we be so blessed to still have them around? But first, just without so many layers, my teacher Eugene Cash spoke about gratitude, the emotion of gratitude and the practice of gratitude, as the fifth Brahmavihara. In the Buddhist system, there are these four heart practices that are really states of universal love or world peace wishing, known as the Brahmaviharas, the dwelling places or the pilgrimage pathways of the divine. And that second translation is a little, it's not so often given. The word vihara is a very interesting word in Pali and Sanskrit. It means dwelling place. So then we very often translate the word Brahma Vihara, these heart practices, as the divine abidings or the dwelling places of the divine, and I think that's appropriate, that the states of love and compassion and joy and equanimity are, in a sense, our clearest contact, in many cases, feels like our clearest contact with what feels like the deepest truth, in many ways, of the universe. When we contact the kind of love or care that the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, joy at the well-being of others, and equanimity, deep, balanced ease in the heart. Many times folks will report that this is what God must feel like, or what it feels like to be in the presence of God, or to be God, or to contact the divine, whether you think of gods or goddesses in the personalized form or not, doesn't matter. So these are dwelling places of the divine. or blessed dwelling places. But vihara also means pilgrimage, because a vihara wasn't just any old house. It's the viharas are in South Asia, these huts that are set up along the popular pilgrimage routes. So you'd be walking from village to village, from temple to temple, from sacred site to sacred site. And every so often, you know, there are some of these, like, up on the Pacific Crest Trail, you hike the trail, and there's these little cabins you can stay in if you're way out in the middle of nowhere for free, or they used to be anyway. And so a vihara is actually a hut for spiritual pilgrims who are on a pilgrimage. So it's not just a dwelling place, but it's a kind of a nourishing rest stop on the path, on the spiritual path. And that's a beautiful shift in our sense of it, because particularly in the early Buddhist system, they're not places you live forever. It's not like, oh, you get reborn in the Brahma Vihara of loving kindness, and then that's like heaven and you're there forever. It's more like it's a meditative state that heals your broken heart and fills your body with ease and pleasure and rapture and joy and bliss and energy and love, and then spreads out to all beings. So we talked about it a couple weeks ago as a prayer for world peace, because all of these states point at not the personal form of the heart quality, but they point to the universalization of that quality. So you practice loving the people you actually love, and then you practice loving yourself, and then you practice loving people you don't really know, and then you practice loving people that you don't like, and then finally you work your way out to loving everyone everywhere. And that's really metta, or loving kindness itself. So those are the Brahma Viharas, these beautiful states that we stop off in to rest and nourish ourselves and learn how to be taken care of and caretake others on the path, and then we continue on the path. And so Eugene, my teacher, would call gratitude the fifth Brahma Vihara. I've just been told that the connection is unstable, so let me know if I disappear on you. He would call it the fifth Brahma Vihara because it behaves in some ways the same way. The Brahma Viharas are these heart states that you can enter and stabilize in deep meditation, where the usual fluctuating energy of emotion gets stabilized, and you immerse in it until you are saturated and resting in these particular wholesome or beautiful emotional qualities of love or compassion or joy or balance or gratitude. So gratitude is not technically a Brahma Vihara, but he uses it that way. And I think that some of the beauty in thinking of it that way is in how gratitude can be something that we practice over and over, and it's widely celebrated that gratitude as a daily practice improves so much about our life. To spend a few moments before bed or early in the morning recalling to ourselves things that we're grateful for, that it becomes an emotional state then that we could immerse into, that we could really settle into and rest into the sense of being grateful for all that is received. And of course, this is a state in the Buddhist system that is considered wholesome, particularly for monastics who depend on generosity for their entire livelihood. And so a kind of feeling of gratitude is almost built into the whole system. The place I think that it is interesting as a Brahma Vihara is that more than the others, because it's inward pointing, like I'm grateful for things that have come to me initially, the pathway from that to all beings is maybe a little less linear. Like, I can be grateful for the good things that have happened to others, but then to spread out to all beings everywhere requires a little leap. Because in a way it has to loop around. Like, with loving, I can just be like, oh, all beings, I love them. To say I'm grateful for that which has come to all beings requires, in a sense, sensing all beings and then the way that those beings are given what they need, or might be given what they need. My friend Oren calls gratitude a subset of the third Brahmavihara, empathic joy, or mudita. In mudita practice, you think of someone else's good fortune, and you celebrate that, you know. So if my friend, you know, got, you know, a beautiful new job, or moved to a beautiful place, or was just healthy and happy in their life, I could think about them and I could feel happy for their happiness. And so, in a way, I think this is the kind of pathway that formal gratitude practice takes. If I want to think about other people, if I was going to do, you know, gratitude practice for someone like, you know, like one of you here tonight, I would think about you and I think, oh, you're grateful for your friend. I'm grateful for you that you have your friend, right? And I could think about that. And like all the Brahmaviharas, I would hold that thought as a way to trigger the emotion. And I would kind of just let it bubble in me, say, oh, how wonderful it is that you have this good thing. And so I would lean into the feeling in that way. So the practice of gratitude might look like that if we were spreading out from ourselves. Very, very often, it's really taught primarily as a practice around being grateful for what has come to us individually. And I should say that there has been some there's been some critical pushback against gratitude as the most popular practice among comfortable white folks, because it might not be immediately apparent to folks who are really trying to be grateful for all they've been given that that much of what they've been given is based in privilege and is not actually being given to others. And so then there's been some critique of, like, is this actually the best practice that we should be doing? So I'm not going to dig into that side tonight, but it's worth saying just that that exists as a thing to reflect on. Like, is gratitude the right practice for me right now? Or is something else, you know, like flipping it around and just focusing on generosity, a more wholesome practice for me in this moment? So that's a start on gratitude. So here's, to make it really basic, here's the way the early Buddhist system talks about this. And I want to see if I can screen share just to... Yeah, let's try that so that you can see the text, if you want to. Here's a text. This is a text from the Anguttara Nikaya, and here's a very simple old definition. Here's the entire discourse. Mendicants, or bhikkhus, monastics, I will teach you the level of the bad person and the level of the good person. Listen and pay close attention, I will speak. Yes, sir, they replied. That's what they say all the time. The Buddha said this. What is the level of the bad person? The bad person is ungrateful and thankless, for the wicked only know how to be ungrateful and thankless. It is totally the level of a bad person to be ungrateful and thankless. And then he flips it around. The good person is grateful and thankful, for the virtuous only know how to be grateful and thankful. It is totally the level of a good person to be grateful and thankful. So that's pretty straightforward. It's awesome to be grateful and thankful. It's pretty lame to be ungrateful and thankless. And the way I read this mostly is that the wholesomeness here, the virtue in gratitude and thankfulness, is that there's a respect for generosity as the basis of relationship. And of course, for monastics, as I just said, generosity is the basis of the entire livelihood. So for a monastic to be ungrateful, in a certain way, is not just kind of rude, but it's actually, in a certain way, dangerous. Like, one of the things that in the early system is most critiqued for monastics is if monastics do anything that would endanger the relationship between the monks and nuns and the lay people. In other words, if monastics are unskillful, unvirtuous, offensive, the lay people won't support them, because why would they? And if the lay people don't support them, then they can't live. And so, you know, if there's a batch of bad monks in the monastery, it's not just for their own well-being and liberation that they should learn how to be ethical and kind and generous and modest and humble and all the good monkly qualities. It's really for the preservation of the entire community that they should be ethical and kind and be a good example, you know, that you're really a good monk or nun as a gift for your fellow monks and nuns. Because if you're a bad monk or a nun, it looks really bad, and it could actually endanger the survival of the community. And I think this piece is tremendously important as an antidote to a kind of hyper-individualism that I certainly have inherited in American culture, that many of us inherit here, that my own practice, even my practice of ethics, really, in a certain way, comes down to me. You know, I'm on the path to liberation, I'm purifying my actions, etc., etc., etc. And to flip it around and say, to be cultivating the virtuous and wholesome qualities is a gift that I give to my community because I'm part of it. Because community is actually my home, and I care for it, and I want to nurture it. And so I think, again here, the gratitude practice turns around quickly to generosity practice. And of course, they're completely folded together. There can't be gratitude without some generosity having happened. And so the practice weaves between the appreciation of these two, basically, roles in relationship that we oscillate between in all of our relationships. At one moment, you're the one that's giving. In another moment, you're the one that's receiving. And then we can say, ultimately, of course, as the separate self relaxes its grip on your life, it's not even just like I'm receiving, I'm giving, you're receiving, you're giving, but that there's just a flow of energy. It's a flow of resources, a flow of kindness, of communication, of contact. And here I always think of the title of this beautiful book by by Lewis Hyde, incredible, I think, sociologist or anthropologist or something, book called The Gift, The Erotic Life of Property. And it's an examination of gifting cultures in some indigenous cultures and kind of various examples around the world, kind of an anthropological study of gifting and giving and how the contact that happens when there's a gift and it's received is profound and intimate. And I think in a certain way this intimacy is so imperative in a Buddhist economy, because it's what makes actual contact possible, which is what we're doing here. which is what we're attempting to do here. I say actual contact as I broadcast at you from, you know, the bedroom of a yoga teacher friend in a small mountain town, you know, 600 miles from you. It's wild. But there's a huge Ganesha statue in the corner of the room. So, I'm in good hands, perhaps, such as it is. I hope. So I want to read you one other bit of ancient discourse that perhaps speaks to the challenging question that maybe we can talk about in the discussion a little if you want to, of, you know, what to say to your, I'll just use the stereotype, parents who voted for the wrong people at some point, let's say. What to do, you know, in intimate contact where there's disagreement. And particularly, let's just say parents, if we have them. So here's another discourse. This is the discourse immediately below the one that I just shared. So they're connected in a certain way. Anguttara Nikaya 233, I think, or something like that. Mendicants, I say that these two people cannot easily be repaid. What two? Mother and father. You would not have done enough to repay your mother and father, even if you were to carry your mother around on one shoulder and your father on the other, and if you lived like this for 100 years, and if you were to anoint, massage, bathe, and rub them, and even if they were to defecate and urinate right there, even if you were to establish your mother and father as supreme monarchs of this great earth, abounding in the seven treasures, you would still not have done enough to repay them. Why is that? Parents are very helpful to their children. They raise them, nurture them, and show them the world. We'll just pause there. Ha ha. They do all sorts of things, perhaps including those and other things. And this is a very classic, ancient sentiment in many cultures, certainly in the South Asian culture that this comes from, that you are more in debt to your parents than anything else, and that debt is almost impossible to be repaid, because they gave you life, they took care of you when you were vulnerable, etc. And of course, you know, lots of us have been abused by parents, or neglected by them, or in many ways not been helped, particularly by them. So this becomes a very complicated teaching, especially for those who were wounded in the parental-child relationship, which is so many of us now. And so I hold that really as true and very tenderly. But here is this ancient sentiment that still, no matter what, and we can say, maybe that's what the line, even if they were to defecate and urinate right there, like even if they're tremendously offensive and they ruin your clothes, you know, whatever it is, you still can't repay them. And that's profound, right? In many layers that are difficult to contend with sometimes. But then it's the last line that really I wanted to bring into this conversation. And this is a standard teaching in the Buddhist system, that the way that you can repay them is that you can bring them to the Dharma. You can bring them to practice that will liberate them. It's the best gift ever, is the Dharma. So it says this: but you have done enough, more than enough, to repay them if you encourage, settle, and ground unfaithful parents in faith, unethical parents in ethical conduct, stingy parents in generosity, or ignorant parents in wisdom. So this is also very interesting. So what you can do is you can bring them to practice. And then it really lists these four particular ways. I like these verbs. You encourage, settle, and ground. So you don't just preach at them, but you do what you can to establish in them a connection to authentic practice. You encourage, settle, and ground unfaithful parents in faith, unethical parents in ethical conduct, stingy parents in generosity, or ignorant parents in wisdom. You bring to them the core. The first three are really the three basic foundational pieces in Dharma practice, right? Faith, ethics, and generosity are like the bedrock of practice. If you don't have those, everything else is shaky. That's the heart. And then, ignorant parents in wisdom. So I'll tell a little story about the monk Shariputra, one of the Buddha's great disciples, who the Buddha outlived him. So the Buddha's like 85, Shariputra's a little older, and Shariputra is dying. Shariputra is known as the foremost in wisdom of all the early monastics. And he's had an incredible career as a monk. He's fully enlightened. He's an arahant. He has been for his whole career as a monk, pretty much. He got enlightened when he had been a monk for 2 weeks. Take that. And talented. And he's dying, and he says to the Buddha, you know, who he's lived with for, you know, decades now, he says, I'm so sorry, Blessed One, but I can't die here with you and the community who I love so much. I have to go home and see my mother, who is still alive. So she's pretty old now at this point, clearly. So he takes his leave, and it's said that as he leaves the grove where the bhikkhus are gathered, the rumor spreads, like, the venerable Shariputra is leaving for the last time, and the bhikkhus, the monks, are weeping, and they start following him down the road, just like, you know, we have to stay close to you, you know, beautiful, beautiful, you know, Dharma brother. And but eventually he sends them back, and he makes his way alone, or maybe, I think, with one attendant, to his hometown. And he makes it, you know, walking slowly to his hometown. And when he gets there, it's nightfall, and someone offers him a place to stay at night in a garage, and it turns out to be the garage of his parents' house. So he stays in his own garage as a beggar, without them knowing. And then in the morning, he goes for alms, and he goes to the house, and he meets his mother. And the commentaries tell us that his mother actually has not been happy that he was a monk. She doesn't really like the Buddha. She doesn't like, you know, beggar monks. She kind of wished he had done something else. I don't know anything about that one. Sorry, Mom. But she agrees to have a conversation with him, and he sits down and he talks with her, and in the sort of terse way that the early texts say, it says, you know, he spoke to her, he gave her a gradual discourse, which is what it always says you do with people who aren't established in faith. So he talked to her about the way things are, and that things are impermanent, and that that there is suffering. He basically gives her the Four Noble Truths, talks about ethics and generosity. And this is a formula that's used for the Buddha as well. It's kind of stock. It says, and then when he could tell that her mind was receptive, her heart was receptive and open, then he gave her the teaching that is distinctive to the Buddha's, which is the teaching of suffering and its end, and the release through letting go of craving. And the text says that that his mother listened with her whole heart, and she heard his teaching, and by the end of his teaching to her, she had opened her wisdom eye, and she was established in stream entry, which is the first of the layers of awakening. And it means that once she's established in stream entry, she will inevitably become liberated within 7 lifetimes at the most. So it's your guarantee of no more backsliding into ignorance. And so once she's established in stream entry, Shariputra, you know, kind of bows to her, honors her, and leaves. And he goes back out to the wilderness and dies there. And you know, saying that, you know, I've repaid my debt. I believe, I'd have to go back and look at the text, but I think that he, you know, he repeats this basic teaching that, you know, I've repaid their gift to me of life, that I was able to be liberated in this life, and I have given that wisdom back And so this teaching that says, you know, establish your parents in faith, in ethics, in generosity, in wisdom, suggests to me, and I'll end with this, and then we can just chat about it and see kind of what of this bubbles up for you. It suggests to me that in this complicated question that's often asked, like, what should I say to my parents? You know, like, I disagree with their choices, like, should I make a thing of it? You know, do you say something when your racist uncle says something at the table, or do you not? The standard answer now is like, yes, you say something, but that's hard. And so this text, I think, offers us a couple of pathways. It offers us a pathway to say, like, there is this encouragement to lean in and say, like, the thing you can do, the thing you should do, that is not against them or trying to correct them or trying to be right. It's not trying to win the argument. It's actually trying to repay a debt, to repay their generosity to you by bringing them to faith, ethics, generosity, and wisdom. To speak, you know, and of course, using wise speech as skillfully as we can, to speak in ways that bring our parents toward what we know to be true. And of course, that's a challenging one. Like, what am I confident actually about the thing that I would bring to them? I don't know, you know. I think, therefore, it's helpful that it gives us a little list. It's like, well, okay, I'm not trying to convince them that, you know, what's the news from this week? Yeah, well, Ivanka also used her private email for government business, so lock her up, you know, like, whatever. I'm not going to do that, right? I wouldn't do that anyway, but I'm not going to do that. It says establish them in faith, you know, establish them in ethics. So, like, oh, is there a way that they're not being ethical that I could speak to? Is there a way that they are stingy, the text says, you know, that I could encourage more generosity? Faith is a hard one. Like, very often, as convert Buddhists, at the end of retreat, they say, you know, don't go and try to convert your parents. Because that's kind of annoying. It's true. It is. But here's a text that actually says, like, go convert your parents. It's the best gift you could possibly give them. And that one, you know, we could talk about how we might hold that. In relation to, like, you know, respecting their faith, for instance, what that might mean. And then bringing them to wisdom and the encouragement that it's appropriate to lean in with some engagement, energy to ignorance and stinginess and you know, unethical conduct and faithlessness, doubt, when we see it. So I take this as an encouragement to speak and to lean in. But in a very particular way, right? In a kind of humble and contained way to those relationships. Trying to bring the best of ourselves to the family table, and not get caught in craving for being right or for other people to be different than they are. So that's sort of two talks in one, gratitude and convert your parents. But there you go. Two discourses right next to each other for Thanksgiving. So let's see how discussion works on this sort of virtual maneuver. But any thoughts or reflections here? Or on any aspect of your practice, as always?
Were you able to hear everybody's name, just so I know if you're able to hear people talking here?
I was. I think it was pretty good, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, if I can't hear someone, I'll ask.
How you perceive the level of openness to your parents to have. So if it, like the amount of information that you give seems to be proportional to that. At least to me, I was like thinking about how my conversation with my dad versus my mom would go.
Yeah.
The amount that I load on them would be extremely different.
It, so for sure.
How many different kinds of conversations could occur with parents.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Maybe more than the sutta, you know, the discourse. I get a lot in this direction from the story about Shariputra. You know, that like his mom was kind of resistant to the Dharma her whole life and didn't want to listen to it much. But in the end, you know, she's dying, he's dying, they're both old, and she opens up. And we can remember that there's that bit in Wise Speech about wise speech being timely. Like, is it the right time to speak about these things? You know. And that points to context in so many ways, just the way you're saying, like, what exactly are they ready to hear? What's going to be most skillful to bring to them? And just to say, you know, I'm using the word convert a little bit tongue-in-cheek, which is to say, I'm not actually, like, Buddhism is an evangelical religion. I would love to convert my parents. But that's not where most of us are at, and I have not converted my parents. Just to be honest, my dad is happily as Catholic as ever. He respects what I do. But you know, hasn't joined the team. As it were. But what you're saying, who is that, by the way, that spoke?
My name is Lana.
Hey, Lana. Yeah. Lana, what you're saying is so true, just to the complexities of relationships, right? Like you know them so well, and you probably know in kind of layers of intimate detail exactly what each of them is available for, and what might land and what might not.
What might trigger them, like what pieces of information
could
trigger things that they would have to face themselves with.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this, you know, that stock phrase when Shariputra gives the discourse to his mom, or the Buddha gives a discourse to someone, often a lay person, always a lay person, it's like this. It says, you know, he gives a gradual discourse, starting with, and the gradual discourse means that it starts with things that are obvious, you know, like that kindness is better than cruelty, which I know the world is the way it is, this is not actually obvious to everyone, but it starts, we could say, with things that the listener is going to agree with. So there might be an encouragement here to be like, okay, what's the common ground first? Or what's the least radical thing you could bring first? And it suggests that you bring these kind of simple, easy to agree with truths. And I don't know, I'm thinking about the Leonard Cohen song, it says, you know, she gets you on her wavelength. And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, you got to get them on your wavelength. And if you don't, then you kind of just, I don't want to trigger my parents, like, necessarily. I want to be skillful enough to bring forward that which is going to really land and be effective. And that probably takes a lot of skill and mistakes. you know, over time. I think mostly what I want is that I don't make a big enough mistake that there's an unrepairable rupture. But yeah, you know, Shariputra preaches to his mom. She hasn't been available for it. He goes slow. And he only really drops the mic on it when she's ready. Yeah, and his. Sometimes it takes that long. In the Buddhist framework, that's no problem. Because, you know, if he establishes her in stream entry, an innumerable series of future lives is shifted. So it's fine to get enlightened only right before you die. It's just as useful as earlier. Earlier is nicer, but you get to hang out with it more. But I think it's appropriate that it's the end of their lives. Like, you know, that's the moment when people open up and get kind of raw and more available, right? Defenses go down once you're closer to that threshold. So I'm not surprised that that's when it happened. Then it's often when it happens.
I think in the time with parents, if you can't directly say something in terms of a conversion tactic, you can lay fertile soil by listening and trying to understand where they're coming from, and so that they're really feeling heard rather than challenged.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I experienced in my family that, I don't know, that they maybe feel challenged by the younger generation and they're on the defensive. And so shifting that dynamic to soften it.
Yeah.
Would be one.
Yeah. 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 What does it mean to, you know, to, what's the language in the text? It says like, sorry, let me find it. Encourage, settle, and ground, you know, unethical conduct into ethical conduct. Like, encourage, settle, and ground. Like, the encourage, I think, is really beautiful. It's not confrontational, you know. It's like, oh, how do I encourage the wholesome qualities? And certainly some of that is making, you know, patient, kind, generous connection as best we can.
Yeah, when you say settle and ground, I think of when somebody feels heard and loved, and I know that when that's the case for me, I'm able to feel more grounded.
Yeah, and less defensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know for me, so often I felt either just aversive or, you know, or confrontational with my parents, especially as I started to learn, you know, how right I was and how wrong they were about the world, right? Somewhere around 19 or so, 19 or 20, how little they knew and how much I suddenly knew. But that persisted well into, you know, the second decade or so of Dharma practice, where that, you know, the sense that I was right had mellowed somewhat and I was kinder, but there was still a sense of kind of basic aversion, I would just say, to their worldview, to their actions. after my mom died, I actually totally had this, like, judgment that my father should go become a monk. That, like, now that this was his chance to, like, devote the rest of his life to spiritual practice. And the fact that he didn't do that and got remarried, for a while I was totally like, Dad, you blew it. And it, you know, and this was, like, I've been practicing for 20 years when this happened. And I was just like, at some point I was like, dude, it's totally not your prerogative to tell your dad what to do in this way. I was totally like, that's ridiculous. And it was amazing how easily convinced I was that, like, I knew the thing he should do now. And so just practicing with that aversion was difficult, and it was really challenging. And I think that's one way we might interpret, you know, the ancient kind of honor your parents teaching here. You know, it says, like, oh, they gave you so much. How could you possibly repay them? You should totally venerate them, basically. This is a very Asian teaching, very much not Western teaching, even though honor your father and mother is in the Bible as well. But, you know, what if that teaching of, like, being thankful to them, being grateful to them, is a way of saying that there are layers of judging them or being aversive to them that are, that might even be grounded in appropriate criticism, but that are inappropriate to the relationship. That in a certain way, a kind of honoring of them is just important. Even if you can see the shadow, you know, in so many ways. Is that a hand? And it is it? Hi. Yes. Orly. Hey, Orly. Yeah.
In general, when I know that we use our pair of brains, we use our journey in life to come to respect what we've learned and what we hold dear, and it's sort of like our existence variable to develop an essence of belonging.
Yeah.
And if your father's new wife,
yep.
Please?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so this is just something that brings the thought that your father's journey brought him in a place where these girlfriends, these 30,000 view of the world,
yeah,
of what's wholesome, grounded, is actually making strides in his belonging, in his essence of,
yeah,
having that existent ground parameters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's tremendously important. And, you know, I think it's important to say this, again, I'm using the word convert a little bit tongue-in-cheek. The sutra doesn't say, you know, establish them in wise view and establish them in the Eightfold Path and get them to become ordained, right? That's not the teaching, actually. But it just says, bring ignorance to wisdom. Ground them in wisdom. And certainly there's, you know, there's aspects of faith and generosity, you know, and ethics and wisdom in so many traditions that it's actually profoundly respectful of me if what I actually do is not try to make my dad a Buddhist at all, and but to encourage and learn about and nurture the ways that he is or wants to and is in the process of deepening in his own faith, of course, and very much what you're saying around this vast view. And a very kind and sympathetic view of everyone being, on their own path.
Yeah.
in that way. So I hold that and the, you know, Shariputra teaching his resistant mother just kind of next to each other. You know, both as beautiful and true ways to be in a relationship. I can see your silhouette. Your silhouette is smiling. Yeah. 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 So here's a challenging one to end us with, or close to end us with. What if that one makes sense to you? Like, okay, I'm not going to try to convert my parents to a different religion, but to deepen them in ethics and generosity and wisdom and faith within the tradition they are in. If that one makes sense to you, what if it's the same about politics? What if in America right now our party is a little bit religious, in the intensity with which we cling to its doctrines and practices? What if a respectful way to go and be with my Republican parents would be to deepen their faith, ethics, generosity, and wisdom within that framework, rather than try to convince them of mine? This one I almost immediately can't really preach on, because I'm not quite sure how I would do that myself, partly because I can tell that I've already decided through my own education that you know, the other party is irrevocably unethical. So, like, I can't imagine how I could convince a dyed-in-the-wool Republican right now to be deeper in their faith and wisdom on the Republican path without somehow being like, but being ethical and being Republican are incompatible right now. And I don't think that's actually true, but that would be the work that I would have to do if I wanted to take that on as a task, to actually respect someone's ideological affiliation. I'd have to figure out how to see the humanity in it, of course. And I think for many of us in family, where there's deep ideological differences, this actually becomes a beautiful practice to try to not just, you know, convince them that they're so wrong and bring them around to our obviously better point of view, but to hold out for ethics and all the rest without thinking that that means they have to change their worldview. And that one I have to really chew on, so we can keep talking about it. But yeah, I'm curious if anyone has a thought on it before we close. Could you support someone to have very different views from yours, and still encourage them in ethics, generosity, faith, and wisdom, without demanding that they, you know, change teams? The gradual path. Yeah. Yeah. I think in many ways part of our task as practitioners who go into those kinds of conversations is to find that little piece to start with, you know. That's obvious and you know, I'll use the word from our founding religious documents. You have to find the truth that is self-evident.
Yes.
And start there. All right. Good. It's a good place to stop for the night. Thank you, everyone, for tolerating or being, you know, game for a technological experiment. It, on my end, this was a success. It's, I feel you. I feel like I'm sitting in circle with you all. It's awesome. So I hope it, yeah, it wasn't too distracting to have the screen and all of that be the way that, that we're in conversation this evening. It's a pleasure to be with you. I recorded the talk, so it'll be up on my site, as always, shortly. And as always, here we are fully embedded in the intimacy of generosity and exchange. So thank you for your gifts that sustain this circle to continue meeting each week with no set price available to all. Your offerings of your resources are absolutely necessary for the sustaining of the studio and myself in being able to do this. So I thank you for your generosity tonight and always in our work together. You can leave money in the wooden box in the back if Lisa grabbed it, or just at the desk. It's great.
Yes, I do.
Awesome. You know the drill, all the stuff. And Lisa, to you, thank you again so much for holding the space and the group. Really a pleasure. And it's easy to know that everything is cared for when you're on it. So thank you.
Thank you. This is, I think it's, you know, I'm seeing some nodding heads. Yes, this is working.
Great. So, yeah. Great. So we're moving to Albuquerque, and I'll see.
No, we're
not.
Working that well.
Not that well. No, all's good. But thank you, everybody, and I'll be back next week. Take good care, and blessings this weekend, however you celebrate in any form.
Thanks, Sean.
Bye-bye. Good night, everybody.